record us in the back.
Yeah,
or make the print so small you have to have a magnifying glass with it. One of these days they'll have a little microfilm thing, wristwatch type of thing, where you can just, you know, and have it project out onto a little screen out there. Right.
Then if your batteries are dead, you're out of luck that day.
Well, make it so hard.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. Yeah, right. Very interesting. Okay, we're still reviewing here, and we'll do so as long as we need to. I don't think we'll get quite finished today, but probably early next week. There's just so many things involved here. It's amazing, the Hebrew, we're almost done reviewing in Hebrew, and the Hebrew will beat the Greek here as far as review is concerned. I don't know if there's any significance to that or not. Genitive absolute, we're looking on page 179. We're talking about present participles and uses of the participles. I talked about the difference between the attributive participle usage and the circumstantial. But yes, yeah, it's right over there. Okay, and there's one more thing that needs to be put under this category of circumstantial participle, and that's this construction called genitive absolute. So section 228 gives the information on that. A circumstantial participle and a noun or pronoun in the genitive case with which the participle agrees form the construction called the genitive absolute, provided that the noun or pronoun in the construction does not refer to a person or thing mentioned elsewhere in the sentence. So, if you see a noun in a genitive, it's kind of detached. In other words, it's not referring, obviously, to something else in the sentence. It's not a slave to something else in the sentence. And yet here you see a noun in the genitive and then a participle attached to the noun in a circumstantial position. That will constitute what we call genitive absolute. And so the participle may have its object in usual case and other adjuncts. The construction may sometimes be rendered by an English participial expression, but more frequently it is best translated by a clause introduced by while, when, because, since, as the context indicates. The noun or pronoun in the genitive functions as the subject of the participle. So these are situations. Now you see, you can translate circumstantial participles in general by things like while or since or as very frequently. The genitive absolute is used in situations where the while, since, or as clause is dealing with a clause and whose subject is different than any of the other elements in the main sentence. In other words, you're usually talking about some circumstance or action or thing that's going on over here that is linked time-wise to the thing that you're interested in, but not linked pronoun-wise or individual-wise. You know, this person's not doing one thing over here and another thing over here. Look at the example here. Zontos tu andros moikalis chrematise. While since the husband is living, or while since or because the husband is living, she will be called an adulteress. Now, the idea here is that it's while the husband is living, she will be called this. So you have an independent sentence, as it were, she will be called an adulteress, but then it's while the husband is living, not while she is living. See, if it was while she is living, she'd be called an adulteress, then you'd use the circumstantial participle construction and have the participle agreeing with her. But now we have the participle having to agree with something else, her husband. And that's an independent subject, and therefore the genitive absolute construction is what you want in a case like that. Yes?
You mentioned it's related with time. Didn't you have like an aorist participle here? And so it's saying something like, since the husband lived, she is now called an adulteress.
Right, it could be too. In fact, since is another possibility there. Since, you know, in other words, the time doesn't, it does usually involve time or something of that nature, but it's not necessarily same tense time. In other words, you may have, you know, yes, right. You could have different time values to each of the participles. And if you had an aorist participle, for example, you'd have action antecedent to the action of the main verb. And then you would probably translate it something like since or because even. So you might get a because or a since idea out of that too. OK? Okay, yeah.
You mentioned last year that because, you know, gives you a strong causal effect, not necessarily legitimate to this form.
Right.
Can you really get away with saying
only if you have, you know, have enough context to indicate. See, something like because is a certain type of commitment. You know, we can in Greek give very clear cause and effect relationships with other words and so forth that we'll be exploring in some of these other clause relationships. And so that's why I gave a caution about a translation of because, simply because of the fact that there's that cause and effect relationship that's usually implied. And in a genitive absolute, you may not see that. It may or may not be there. It won't be there just because of genitive absolute construction, though. If it's there, it's there because of genitive absolute construction plus the meaning of the words, or, you know, it depends on the kind of words that you're dealing with, the kind of situation you're dealing with. And many times we may go ahead and translate it because in the situation where it's obviously from context, from the meaning of the words involved, the sequence of the time involved, and other things, that it's going to be cause and effect. But don't assume that just because it's genitive absolute, you're going to see cause and effect. It won't necessarily be the case. There's far less ambiguous ways to express that idea. Okay, so that's just a caution. We want to be a little careful so that we don't just see a genitive absolute and then translate it because and then go on your way, and then look back at that later on and see a cause and effect relationship that wasn't necessarily implied by the Greek. So we have to be real careful what's there and what isn't there. Well, yes, a conditional is a little bit closer to what's happening. It's a little bit closer than a cause and effect. And you've kind of, you know, reworded it a little bit, but context is going to be your guide as to which sense should be taken. Sometimes there's an equivalence pretty much in English. While this is happening, then this will happen. You get an if then almost from the same kind of situation. And of course, an if then situation, a conditional, still is not the same as cause and effect. There's a difference there as well, but sometimes the cause and effect may be the reason for a conditional, but other times there may not be any cause and effect relationship at all. There just may be a conditional relationship that's necessary. So these things get into kind of logical problems too, and that's a level of discussion that's above and beyond grammar even. So what we need to know is know what the grammar does, and then look at other considerations in terms of semantics and the types of words, the context, and so forth, to make some decisions as to what kind of translations are best. That's one of the values of really getting a working knowledge of the grammar, is to know what it says, what it doesn't say, and then pick up your other cues for translation from context and other things, and kind of know where you're at and what you can and what you can't say. One of the biggest problems, I think, sometimes is that a person will say, well, the Greek says this. If you don't know anything about the grammar, you're kind of stuck, you know, either to just question them on no basis at all, or to just not, you know, be forced to accept what they say, and you don't want to be in that kind of a position. So this is part of the reason why we get down to the nuts and bolts of all of this and try to make some fine line distinctions when we have to. As we're translating, of course, we're going to be calling attention to many of these things and asking some questions about what can we and can't we say about this. Is there a cause and effect relationship here, for example, if we see a genitive absolute, things of that nature. Okay, yes.
It's like people when there's some really crazy ideas they have about certain Bible doctrines, like the one in Genesis where they say Hayah could mean
became, yeah, the gap theory.
Seems like they bring a list of possibilities and they pick the most remote one. It's like a skill to picking the lack is picking what's the probable interpretation.
Right.
It's just allowed.
Right. Yes, I think that you have to be always on the guard for that kind of thing, because there are people who are trying to find a range of possibility, and then because it fits a certain doctrine that they want, they try to stuff that particular part in. It's the same thing with prepositions. They'll look up the preposition that can mean all these different things, and then they say, aha, this is what we want. You know, Prost and John 1:1, you know, translate it with, because they've got this Trinitarian idea they're trying to bolster, instead of really honestly considering what the real function of the word is, and look at it from a grammatical standpoint without reading your theology into it. It's a skill that's not easy to come by among human beings, to really be objective. We're talking about objectivity, you know, and that's what your biggest problem is. But like you said, there's very often picking the unusual or the possibility and then jamming that in. Now, we need to make a discrimination between that and legitimate cases in which the unusual is probably the correct one, just because there are contextual considerations that demand that from a grammatical standpoint, independent of, you know, a person's theology. So we have to deal with it on a couple of levels. You know, when you're doing good Bible exegesis, you're going to want to examine things from a grammatical standpoint and a lexical standpoint, just on the basis of what the meanings of the words are. And if you have ambiguities, by the time you get done with that analysis, then those ambiguities are going to have to be resolved by other considerations. And parallel passages and the rest of Scripture, of course, is the primary thing there. It should not be the theology you're trying to jam into it, but it should be based on let the Scripture interpret Scripture. And things like the gap theory and so forth would be shot down from that consideration as well. It'd be shot down first because of the grammar itself would be far more supportive of taking it as a simple "and the earth was without form and void." And then, in addition to that, you have parallel passage considerations. And so you have to work from that standpoint. So that's what we're trying to do, is learn to be competent and careful scholars, so we're not making lots of blunders because we're trying to stuff our theology into the text. Okay. If you look at page 180 here, why we were weak, Christ died on behalf of the ungodly. So Christos onton hemon asthenon. There's your genitive absolute phrase. And you've got a participle, onton, and hemon would be your subject of that genitive absolute construction, and then asthenon would be a predicate adjective to the onton there. You would see here now a situation in which, again, we can't say that there's necessarily cause and effect. You see, it doesn't necessarily mean because we were weak, Christ died on behalf of the ungodly. It's not really saying that he died because we were weak. It's saying that he died while we were weak. You see, now there may be some kind of a relationship there in terms of cause and effect, but it's not told us by this construction. This construction is really giving us a temporal relationship between two events, that this event is taking place while this event is taking place. And so, and that's the point of Romans 5, is while we were in that state of ungodliness that he died for us. And in other words, there's this temporal relationship, and the fact that it's not necessarily because we were weak, although that may be involved too, but that's not really what's being said here. It's while we were weak, Christ died for us. And then the other example, Acts 10:44, while Peter was speaking these words, the Holy Ghost fell upon those. And again, you wouldn't want to imply a cause and effect here. It's not necessarily because he was speaking these words the Holy Ghost fell on them. Although, there, you know, the fact that he was speaking those words and bringing certain revelation and bringing certain truth, and their minds and hearts were opening up to it, it's probable that his speaking the words had something to do with the Holy Ghost falling upon them, but not necessarily simply because of those words or because of a certain word that he said or something, then this happened. It's because the people's hearts were opening up while he was doing this, and that was the cause for the Holy Spirit falling upon them. Okay, then there's a remark here about slight exceptions to the rule. The proviso that the noun or pronoun in the genitive not refer to a person or thing mentioned elsewhere in the sentence is sometimes ignored. So I don't know what you do with that. It depends on how often the sometimes is, and statements like that, I think, are open doors to further study and investigation. I always take those things with a grain of salt. But here, while he was speaking these things, many believed in him. I suppose that part of it is because the him here is the object of a prepositional phrase, and that's not as central to the sentence structure as say a subject or an object, direct object would be, and that may be a reason why it's a little bit looser as far as an example like this. One would to really make a solid conclusion on this, I would have to look at all the examples where the genitive absolute construction was used, and there was another reference in the sentence, and see if there's a characteristic pattern there. That might be a good study for somebody to do in the future in a grad program or something. Okay, now future participles. It's a relatively short chapter. There isn't too much to say about future participles. First of all, because the forms are very regular and very straightforward. As we've seen before, to make a future participle, just like you made the future forms of the verb, you add a sigma onto the base, and then you add your endings. And so the ending system is the same as present participles, but you just add the sigma. For luo, for example, it's luson, lusontos, lususa, for the feminines, lususes, etc., that paradigm, and luson, lusontos, etc., for the neuters. So it's pretty straightforward. There's not really nothing new there. For the contract verbs, you get the same kind of vowel sound before the sigma as you did when you formed the finite forms of the verb. So agapes and poies and plero. So mega on plero o and eta on the other two, and before the sigma, and then you go ahead with your endings just as you would with any other verb. So there's nothing unusual there. Also, even with the me verbs, they're not too bad here. Basic thing there is to know what the stem is, and it's rather short in each case, do, fe, and stay. And then you put a sigma on that, and then you put your endings on just like you would for any other, even a present participle, and you have your paradigm. Nothing, no problem there. The future middle participle, same situation. You add the sigma to the base, then you add your omicron, then you add your men, and then you add your second declension and first declension type adjective endings, and that's straightforward. Okay, and then he's got a contract there, verb there, agapesomenos, same situation there, just using that stem. Future participle of the verb aimi is middle in form. It's esomenos, and of course aimi is a deponent, irregular me verb, and it's got everything unusual in it, so you're not surprised by anything you see there. Okay, so it's passive in form, or middle in form, actually. Then the future passive participle occurs only once in the New Testament. It is formed on the future passive stem. So it only occurs once, so there's really not much point in spending a lot of time on it, although it's quite regular anyway. Remember, you just use your sixth principal part to build it from, and so you get luthe somenos, and it only occurs once. All right, the uses of the future participle. It mentions here that the future participle in this paragraph represents an action as future from the point of view of the main verb. So we talked about this yesterday with participles. The future participle now is going to be looking at the action as future with reference to the main verb. And of course that will very often result in the idea of purpose. It'll indicate the purpose of the action of the main verb. You see, because your view is toward the future. Your view is toward what the future result of something will be, etc. So the idea of result and purpose, etc., is very commonly seen with this just because of the kind of meanings that are associated with future. And if you've got something future with reference to the action of the main verb, and it's being put in the same sentence, there's usually some sort of logical connection between the ideas, and that's going to generally give you a picture of purpose. And this is one of many ways in which purpose is expressed in Greek. So here's a couple of examples, Matthew 27:49, Erkatai Elias, Soson Auton. Elijah is coming to save him. So the idea there is he's coming, Erkatai, he's coming, and then a future participle to save him. He's coming to save him, or in order to save him. And in English, we're translating it with an infinitive, actually. In fact, we'll find with Greek infinitives, you can set up a construction with Greek infinitives like this, too. Future participle isn't used that frequently in the New Testament, so you won't see a lot of examples of this kind of thing. Then I won't take time for all the examples here, but this last example, Hebrews 3:5, marturion ton lalethe somenon, this is that example where the future participle is used, and future passive, excuse me, and it's a testimony of those things which are going to be spoken. So it's a testimony of those things which are going to be spoken. And you've got the future idea there, and it's passive, are going to be spoken. So there's your sense. Future to the action, the main verb, although the main verb isn't actually stated here, would be in the rest of the context. Okay. So purpose isn't always seen there, but in a good number of the cases, that's what you'll see.
Is that considered a genitive absolute, or is that just going to be in the present participle?
No, I think this will just be a normal genitive modifying marturion. So, see, it's a testimony, and then this is a genitive phrase describing that, but it happens to be a participle. Remember, you can actually what you might analyze this as is that this participle is functioning substantively, like a noun in the genitive attached to another noun. Okay. So yes.
I just noticed that all of these examples they translate this. each participle was an infinitive.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To be spoken, you know.
Yeah.
And down the thought, what was going to happen?
Right. What was going to happen, and this one was going to be spoken, the other one is coming to save. This is in 1 Corinthians 15:37, the body that will come into being. They're using that will come. I don't know if that would be...
Intended to be, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The intended to be, you can do it with that. Sure. Yeah, so that's just because of the differences in the languages, and we don't have a very good way in English to express what's being expressed by the future participle with a participle construction. It seems to be just pretty awkward to do it that way. It's a manifestation of the differences in the linguistic systems. Okay, you'll find this too in Hebrew and in Greek. When you start dealing with infinitives and participles, there's a big kind of a crossover in English. Sometimes we'll be translating a participial phrase by infinitives, and we'll be translating an infinitive phrase by participles and relative clauses and all kinds of things. So there's quite a mix in the ways that these things get translated, just because each language is putting emphasis on different ways of expression. Jim?
Question about the past. Sometimes I might have trouble catching the past.
Uh-huh.
Like in the last sentence, those things which are going to be spoken. Mm-hmm. In English, you could put, like, by so-and-so.
Right.
If you attach that onto English, will that make it a, you know, mm-hmm. phrase like that, will that make it a past?
Yes, that'll usually be a good helper. If you have a passive form and you don't have the agent stated, that's where you're sometimes going to maybe miss it. And if you can supply a hypothetical agent, and if the construction will fit, you know, you've got a good indicator that you're looking at a passive. That's a good point. Okay? And, of course, in English, you usually have an auxiliary verb, are going to be spoken. And the forms there will usually tell you too, but sometimes that gets confused with, see, English uses auxiliary verbs for other purposes too, and so you kind of get a confusion there. That's a good way to keep it in mind, I suppose. Okay, and then of course if it states the agent, then you've usually got it quite obvious, you've got a passive construction. Peg?
Yeah, I just wondering to get my understanding right, that the two here as opposed to the definitive, I mean, like
order
to.
Uh-huh. Well, you've got a point there as far as English is concerned. The infinitive can't really stand by itself in English. It always needs this little word to in order to function in a sentence. And even in the dictionary, sometimes they list it with a word to in front of it. And that doesn't necessarily imply quite the same thing as the preposition to when you're dealing with purpose and so forth. I don't know if anybody, English linguists, you know, try to make a distinction there or not. But it's just that when you see an infinitive in an English construction, you're always going to see a to on it. And then you have to kind of look at the context of the English sentence to see if purpose is involved or not. It may not always be involved. So I think that's something good to remember, that the fact that the to is on an infinitive in English doesn't necessarily imply purpose. Okay. So again, we're dealing with two different languages that are not really matching up on this issue. And that's why I like to emphasize, and this year we'll have an opportunity to maybe implement the idea of thinking in Greek rather than thinking in English. In other words, I want us to come to a point, at least by the end of this year, by the grace of God, that as we are translating, we are actually receiving the information into our brains and the meaning into our brains, as it were, without having to say, what's the English equivalent, you know? In other words, we're getting it as we're reading it from the page, and we're getting the meaning of it, and then we're saying, how would I say this in English? Now that I know what it means, how would I say it in English? That's what we're trying to strive for. And the only way that can be attained, of course, is continual exposure to it. First learning the grammatical rules, basically, but then the feeling for it comes as we're into it. And that's the state. When you get to that state, you have a lot more confidence in your translations, even though your translations... You may find a certain frustration in that you're finding, I can't quite find the words in English to say this quite right. I know what it means, but I can't quite say it right. That frustration is only because the linguistic systems are different, and you're probably not going to find a way to say it quite right. But if you're understanding it properly, then you're not going to be making theological mistakes, and that's the thing that we want to zero in on. Okay. Aorist participles, that chapter is a little bit more lengthy. Just because of the variations in the forms that you have to deal with. And I won't go into a lot of detail here except to just briefly look at the paradigms. You see in section 236 the paradigm for your aorist participle for Luo, and we see the sigma added to the base just like we saw before. No augment, though, because we're not dealing with an indicative finite verb form. We're dealing with a participle, and they won't have augments, and neither will infinitive, and so forth, as you'll see later. So we have no augment, but we have the base plus sigma, and then we have a different set of endings, characterized by a thematic alpha again. And this is a very consistent indicator of aorist, this thematic alpha sound. And so we get lusas, lusantos, lusanti, etc. The ending system is still third declension like we saw before, and then going back to first declensions for the feminines, like doxa, and then third declensions again for the neuters. So the pattern is just the same as we saw for our present participle, except that we have thematic alpha now before we have these endings. One more thing to note about them is this. In your nominative singular and your dative plural forms, we get again an assimilation of the new tau. Rather than luon, for example, and then luontos, etc., we didn't have the assimilation of the new tau, we had the assimilation of the sigma. Here the assimilation of the new tau takes place, and we keep the sigma, so we get lusas, and then lusasi, or lusasin for the dative plural. So that's something to watch on those. It's easy to make a mistake on it if you don't catch it and note it right away. All right, that kind of thing we've seen happen before. And so that paradigm is pretty straightforward. Now, if you look at the second aorist paradigm over here in section 237, that's somewhat analogous to things we've seen before also. Remember with the second aorist, instead of adding a sigma to the base, we had a stem change. And that same thing carries through now here. So we have a stem change, and then we go ahead and add the endings that we had for the present participles. Now before, with the second aorist finite verb, we added the endings that were on the imperfect. But here we're adding the endings that are on the present participle. And see, participles have a little bit reduced class of differences in aspect. There's no imperfect participle, for example, and that type of thing. Imperfect isn't involved. So the only past tense participles we have are aorist. And so we're going back to the present type of ending system that we saw before. So lipon, lipontos, and so forth. Now there's one more thing, too, about the second aorist. You've got a stem change, and then there's another key that you can look at that will help you, and that's the accent. The accent is shifted one syllable over, generally. See, normally in your verb forms, the accent is recessive, tries to get as far forward as it can, and according to the rules. Here we find, for example, lipon, it's on the second syllable, lipontos. Instead of lipontos, like you would expect it, it's lipontos. See, the normal accent rules would have predicted lipontos because you can go all the way to the third syllable from the end because of the final being short. But it's not. It's lipontos. So if you're watching accents, that may be of help to you, too. But like I said, we haven't laid a lot of emphasis on accents, so you may be, the main thing you're watching for is that stem change. Now, this means that if you see a participle of a verb that you haven't seen before, and it's got these present participle type endings, you won't be able to know for sure, unless you know whether there's been a stem change or not, whether that is a second aorist participle or a present participle. So that's just kind of a word of caution. This is an area where you have to keep your eyes open, and you have to know the vocabulary. I mean, you have to know what the verb is to know. For example, in this case, if you see lipon, if you didn't have the accents to look at, all you would know is that verb is either a second aorist for a verb that has a stem change, or it's the first, just the present participle for the verb lipo. But there isn't any verb lipo, so it turns out to be from lipo, and you just have to have that knowledge to know what you're looking at. Okay, aorist active participles of contract verbs formed regularly. Again, the same thing. You add that eta, or that vowel changes just before the sigma, and then your pattern is the same as it is for these other ones. The me verbs are formed on their aorist stems, may be obtained quite simply, however, by omitting the first syllable of each form of the present participles. So again, we have the same kind of thing, a stem change plus the present participle endings, and as it turns out, the stem change is such that if you just knock off the first syllable of the present participle, you end up with the aorist participle. So that's kind of nice. The only problem there is to remember that that's what it does. But so the present participle is deduce, dedusa, didon, and the aorist participle is just deuce, dusa, don. You just take the d off the front and you got it. And tithase, same thing, athase, and histos would be stos. So that's one nice feature of me verbs. There are very few. Okay. Then, again, the forms for the middle participles, aorist middle participles. Now, remember, with the aorist, we do have a distinction between middle and passive forms. In the present, of course, you have the middle and passive form. It one form serves for both. But in the aorist, you have a distinction, and that distinction carries through to the participles. We have the men, again, a typical typical morpheme there, showing passive participle information there. And then again, we have the thematic alpha. So you can just see what happens here. Lusamenos would be your form for luo. Adding the sigma, thematic alpha, then the men, and then your second declension, first declension type adjective endings. If it's a second aorist, and you have lipomenos, you'll get the thematic omicron again, because that's typical of the present type endings, but there's been a stem change. Agapesamenos, same thing there as we've seen before. Dominos, feminos, and so forth for the me verbs, and that's pretty straightforward also. Okay, aorist passive participles formed on the unaugmented aorist passive base. So the aorist passive participle now, what are we going to do with that? Well, again, you're dealing with a sixth principal part. And what you do is take your sixth principal part, drop off the augment and the final aid anew, which is kind of the first step for most of these paradigms. And then you add the appropriate morphemes, in this case, a stem vowel epsilon, and then the morpheme nu tau, and so forth, and then epsilon sigma for the feminine. And then the case number suffixes of the third declension, masculine and neuter. So the endings are the same as we saw for the rest of them. It's just a different type of formation of it. We have a thematic epsilon in this case. And so remember, your aorist passive base for luo was eluthane. And you drop off the augment, drop off the eta nu, and that leaves you with luth, with the theta. And then you have put an epsilon on it, and then put your nu tau, and then the third declension endings. So your paradigm will become luthase, luthentos, luthenti, etc. Again, notice on this one that in the nominative singular and in the dative plural, there's been an assimilation of the nu tau. And that's why you keep the sigmas on those. And you get an epsilon iota from the contract rules, and that's kind of, well, the kind of, not really contract rules, but there's an assimilation that takes place that lengthens that vowel sound. So that's the same thing that happened with the aorist active participle there a few pages before. Okay. Now, another thing also, suppose you have a second aorist passive. And the second aorist passive, the major difference was the lack of a theta. And as it turns out, you can make the aorist passive participle by the same rules whether it's first or second aorist, simply because the theta isn't involved in the rule. The rule just says take the sixth principal part and chop off the eta nu and chop off the augment and then add your endings on. And so if you do that consistently, the ones that are second aorist, since they get the same endings, are not going to show up any different, or you don't have to worry about forming the rules for them. For example, grapho is a second aorist, and it was egraphane, and it didn't have a theta. Well, if you take egraphane, drop off the epsilon, drop off the eta nu, then you get graph for your stem syllable, and of course, then you got graphase, graphentos, etc., when you put the endings on, and that's all you need to do. So you don't need to even, in other words, you don't need to mentally make any distinction between first and second aorist as far as forms of these participles. And that's also true even with the finite verb forms. The only thing you need to know is that sixth principal part. That's where the memory work comes in. Because the information given in the sixth principal part will automatically help you determine what the forms are. Now, that's not necessarily true of your second aorist active forms, because there you had a different ending system, and in addition to a stem change. And so you have to remember that. All right. Now, he goes on to say in section 242 that the deponencies, if it's deponent in the future or aorist, then the future aorist participles will be middle or passive form. In other words, For deponent verbs, that deponency carries into the participle construction as well. And so if it's deponent and it's using a passive form, for example, for active meaning in the future, well, the future participle will also be passive in form, or the aorist participle will be passive in form. Okay, then the verb aimi has no aorist participle. So you have no problem with that. Remember, it didn't even have any aorist forms, period. It just had imperfect forms for the past. So it's got no aorist participle. Then section 244, since it is not always clear what the unaugmented form of certain aorist stems may be, the forms of the aorist participles of some important irregular verbs are given below, given in the full list below. This has to do with something we noted even later on too when we got into infinitives and some of the other forms. You can't always tell for sure what the unaugmented form will be of certain ones because remember when a verb begins with a vowel, there are certain rules for augments where you generally get a lengthening. And sometimes some of these rules overlap. In other words, the two different sounds will end up with the same thing, like an eta. For example, if the word began with an alpha and you put the augment on, that turns to an eta. If the word began with an epsilon, you put the augment on, that turns to an eta. So if you see a word that's got an eta on it in one of its forms, you may not be able to work backwards and tell for sure what the initial form was or the unaugmented form was. So he just gives you a chart here with some of the more common ones like that, that will give you that and let you see what the unaugmented form will be to build your participle from. Okay. Again, if you go by memorizing your principal parts, you know, and learning these common verbs that way, you'll have it automatically. You'll know what it is. And we will, this semester, for some vocabulary quizzes, be having quizzes on the principal parts and that chart in the back of the book where you've got your most common verbs and then the six principal parts. So I will be giving you some quizzes here before too long. I'll let you know about it ahead of time. We'll do one like one every 2 weeks or one every week or something like that until we get through the list. We'll take it in sections of about 10 at a time or with 8 at a time. I can't remember exactly how I set it up. So that we get familiar with those principal parts of these common verbs. Okay, but we won't do that until we get to understand what perfect and pluperfect and some of these other tense forms are, so we know what all of them are there for.
How come you don't put pluperfect
in that? Well, because the pluperfect is pretty much built on the perfect. In other words, it's built on the fifth principal part, fourth or fifth, the perfect stem. So, in other words, you only put the minimum number of forms necessary to make all the rest of the forms. And so since the pluperfect is pretty easily formed once you know the perfect, then that's considered, it's not considered a principal part. Okay? And there are very few pluperfect forms in the Bible anyway. And they're not used that frequently. Okay. You can rejoice about that, I suppose. All right. Then the last section here, the last couple of sections on the meanings of them, of the aorist participle, this is where there was some controversy, as you recall. And the question is, he's saying, now I think he's rightly saying that aspect is more important than tense value for the aorist participle. However, you know, it's got that indefinite aspect. However, it's still got a time value. And the aorist participle may therefore refer to any action, whether it be past, present, or future, with respect to the action of the main verb. So he's kind of saying, well, it can be past, present, or future. But if you look at his examples and so forth, to try to support that claim, and this is true in many of the textbooks. Many of the textbooks say the same thing. Although in actual usage, they will admit, most of them, and he does too, that for almost all practical purposes, it's action antecedent to the action of the main verb, and the other uses are very rare. And this is true. I asked Themis, you know, what the situation is in modern Greek, and what does an aorist participle indicate? And he said it's always action antecedent to the action of the main verb. And so that's what he claimed. And that's what I've been able to observe in all the examples in the scriptures that I've seen, is that it's action antecedent to the action of the main verb. Now, there's a couple of places here. Now, first, the first number one here, action antecedent to the action of the main verb, that's straightforward, and that's the usage you're seeing all the time. Having been justified by faith, we have peace with God. See? And dikaiothentes, ek pisteos, there you see action antecedent to the action of the main verb. However, notice this example number two, aorist participle referring to an action simultaneous with that of the main verb. And in support of this, he gives this very common idiomatic phrase, apokritheso Petros epen auto. Peter said in answer to him, or answering, Peter said to him. Having answered, I suppose we might say, since it's an aorist participle, if we translate this, see what he's getting. What he's getting at, if you translate this participle as action antecedent to the action of the main verb, it sounds funny here, because that would mean having answered, Peter said to him, and since we know that his saying is the answer, he couldn't be answering first and then saying. That's their reasoning, and that's the reason why they say, well, it's simultaneous, because the answer is simultaneous with the saying. However, when you're dealing with an idiomatic phrase like this, you need to be careful, because to say what he's saying here is reading English thought patterns into what the Greeks are to a Greek pattern. And I am not convinced that this is an exception to the normal rule. And the reason I'm not convinced is that we may be dealing with a conceptual thing where in answer he's making an answer in his mind, he's making response, and then he's saying it. See, the thought process should come before the speaking. And the answering is dealing with having received the information, having formulated a conclusion and a response to it, and then having that formed in your mind, even though it may be a microsecond before the actual saying is concerned, the answer should be in the mind before it's actually said. It kind of depends on whether you're looking at the answering from the standpoint of the person's mind who is giving the answer, or the person's ears who is hearing the answer. And since we probably think of it more in terms of the latter, then you know, that kind of a simultaneous action is implied. But it may not be the case with the Greeks. And I've been around enough and seen enough Greek to suspect that that's probably what's happening here. So somebody can do a thesis on that someday if you want. But that's the suspicion I have. So I'm just trying to say, take this with a gigantic grain of salt. I don't see any evidence here to overturn what we've already seen. Yes, Greg? No, I asked him about these examples and so forth, and to him it didn't seem to be any problem. And I think I did talk to him about this possibility and so forth, and that seemed to make sense to me. I don't think he was really, really thinking it out. It's probably more something that happens all the time. They talk that way all the time. They're not even aware that it's an exception, you know, or even thinking of it or worrying about it as an exception. So I don't know if he was even thinking. I may grill it next time he comes. Hopefully he'll be here again next year, and we can zero in on this a little bit more. But, of course, we have to be careful, too, that any conclusion that we see about modern Greek may not necessarily apply to ancient Greek either. But at least it's closer than English. Okay? Now, this last example, aorist participle referring to an action subsequent to that of the main verb, where now they're claiming that the aorist participle is used, but the action is actually future to the action of the main verb. Here's the example. They arrived in Caesarea and greeted Festus. So the idea he's saying is, the participle here, aspasmenoi, they greeted him, is aorist, and the what he's thinking is, obviously you arrived someplace before you greet people. So they said he must have arrived in Caesarea first and then greeted Festus, and even though the greeting of Festus is an aorist participle, it must be referring to action antecedent to the action, subsequent to the action of the main verb, because you arrive before you greet somebody. However, that may also be making some assumptions about the customs and about the situation. For one thing, to arrive in Caesarea, they had to arrive at the city was a ways away from the port. And as the ships would come into port, it's very possible that Festus was actually down there at the port, at the dock, as the ship came in and greeted them. And then they moved from there into town and arrived in Caesarea. And so it's very possible, in my opinion, that the greeting actually did precede the arriving in Caesarea. And in some respects, too, you know, there could be a certain amount of ceremony and so forth before they've officially arrived. You know, the dignitaries have to make contact before he's actually received into the city and before he's actually considered to arrive. So, again, I'm not to take this one example and examples like these two that are given here, and to try to overturn everything else on that basis, because I think it may be safer to take the majority of the cases in which this aorist participle is action antecedent the action main verb, and then look at that at these passages from that perspective. So, and then he makes an admission here too. He says, The last usage mentioned above is quite rare, and the second is found most frequently in occurrences of the phrase quoted, apocryphes apen. It turns out, therefore, that in most instances the aorist active participle may be rendered in English, at least in a rough and ready way, by a phrase consisting of having plus an English past participle. An aorist participle may, in most instances, be rendered by a phrase consisting of having been plus the past participle. So, in other words, he's saying action antecedent to the action main verb. Yes?
Then you're saying that it would probably be better, having greeted Festus, they arrived in Caesarea.
Right, right. I would go ahead and translate it that way. I wouldn't see any problem with doing that because of the kinds of customs and situations that existed at the time. Now, that, of course, may be a matter, you know, open for more study and opinions and so forth. I'll just give you my opinion on it at this point and let you take it for what it's worth. And you'll have to make your own decision ultimately on it. But I think we need to be real careful in things like this. I've seen a lot of this kind of thing happen and making some real surface conclusions based. And you see, I also know there's an issue that's not put in print here. That's behind the scenes. And it has to do with when you receive the Holy Spirit, for example, and have you received the Holy Ghost since you believed, and that type of thing, where you see constructions with aorist participles. And because they are believing that you receive the Holy Spirit at conversion, you see, they will use those, and it's to their advantage, theologically, to have the aorist participle be action simultaneous to or subsequent to the action of the main verb. So you have to be careful there, too. There are some ulterior motives involved, and when you see things like that, the alarm bell should ring as well. Okay. So that's something I'd like to see somebody do a paper on. You know, we've in some of the publications for Tongues on Trial and so forth, some of these kinds of issues have been dealt with. And it'd be good to have a whole thesis somebody could do on this very subject. It'd be really worthwhile. Okay, so much for that. As far as the rest of this in section 247 is concerned, it's pretty much straightforward. I don't want to take time for it. The aorist participle basically is used like the present participle in its grammatical syntax. In other words, it's going to be used with anarthrous nouns, with articular nouns in the first attributed, second attributed positions. In a predicate position, it happens apparently very rarely. Normally, we see with the form of the verb to be, just like we did before. And then substantive functions, functioning like a noun, circumstantial, you can have circumstantial participles with aorist participle as well as with present participle, and genitive absolute constructions also with aorist participles as well as with the present ones. And someone asked a question about that, but here's the example. Jesus having been born in Bethlehem, the astrologers came from the east, you see. Jesus having been born, or since Jesus was born in Bethlehem, etc. That kind of thing. Okay. Chapter 32 deals with another important element, the infinitive, this one's a little simpler as far as forms are concerned because we only have one basic form. We don't have a declension of the infinitive, although there are about 8 different types of infinitives you can have here. So, first of all, he gives an introductory chapter on what an infinitive is, and this idea of a verbal noun is probably the basic idea we want to glean from this chapter, from this section. An infinitive is a verbal noun. It's a word that has functions proper to nouns and functions proper to verbs. So as a verb, it can take objects, and indirect objects, things of that nature. As a noun, it can occupy certain positions in a sentence that nouns occupy. It can be the subject of a sentence. It could be the object of a sentence. It could be an object of a prepositional phrase and so forth. So we have kind of a word that's a cross between the two. It's got noun properties and it's got verbal properties. Okay, so with that in mind, let's look at the forms here. Section 249, Greek verbs, as we might expect, are more plentifully supplied with infinitives. We've come to expect that for almost anything now. And the verb luo has its paradigm for its infinitive this way. First, your present active infinitive is luain. Your present middle or passive is luestai. Then your future, you have lusain and lusestai, and then luthesestai. Future passive form, but theoretically exists, although none of them occur in the New Testament. We see that footnote. Then, so for your purposes, you can eliminate that one, I suppose. Then the first aorist, you have lusai, lusastai, and luthenai. So you'll have present, future, and aorist forms for the infinitive. That's all. You don't have any imperfect ones or things like of that nature, at least not that we have to worry about now. There may be some perfect forms later on, but this is all we need to worry about right now. And then, as far as the forms are concerned, there's a kind of a basic philosophy that we've already run into. The present doesn't have any stem formative, but the future has a sigma and the aorist has a sigma. And your aorists have a thematic alpha type sound, so those features you should notice in common. And then as far as the actual suffixes are concerned, there's an analysis of that in section 250 here. And again, I'm not so concerned that you memorize the analysis, as just to learn the forms, basically, whichever is the quickest and easiest for you. No augments, of course, remember. Also, in the aorist, there's no augments, just because, again, we're not dealing with a finite verb form. And he goes on here to look at the contract verbs, what happens to them. You do get a little bit of a difference here because you're adding a vowel to a vowel stem in many of the verbs, in these contract verbs. And so you actually add a different suffix, too. You have epsilon nu instead of epsilon iota nu for the present active. And just a few features like that. So you'll see the paradigm there. Then as far as second aorist, if you have a second aorist, you have a second aorist infinitive. And you add the suffix epsilon iota nu to the unaugmented second aorist base. So again, its ending looks kind of like present, but then there's an accent shift. And use the same ending that you did in the present, but there's been two things, a stem change and a shift in the accent. So here's a few examples of verbs falling into that category. Lego, for example, apon was your second aorist form. So the base was ape, and then you add the epsilon iota nu, and then stress change. So it's apane is the form that you end up with. Second aorist middle infinitive formed by adding the stem formative epsilon and the suffix sti to the unaugmented second aorist base. Again, the same type of thing that you would have done with a present infinitive, except there's been a stem change. Second aorist passive infinitive formed by adding the stem formative eta and the suffix ni. So graphani, for example, to the unaugmented aorist passive base. Then again, the statement about deponency, if they're deponent in the verbs which are deponent in the aorist have aorist infinitives, which are either middle and passive forms. Some verbs have both middle and passive forms. And we've run into that before, too. With ginomai, we had the same thing in the present, so in the normal finite forms. Knee verbs, a little bit different, too, slightly different suffixes and so forth, so you just have to look at the paradigm. It's didonai, tithenai, histonai, so you get the suffix ni rather than epsilon iota nu. I suppose that's the major difference there. Then the verb ami didn't have any participles, but it gets and it only has two infinitives, the present ani and the future ssi, so no aorist or past type of form. Again, since it didn't have any aorist forms and only had imperfect, that's probably the reason this isn't happening. You're not getting any aorist infinitive, of course, since it had no aorist forms. Okay, the tense of the infinitive. Properly speaking, only the future infinitive has tense, in that it always refers to future time relative to the time of the principal verb. So again, it's relative to the time of the principal verb, and it's only the future infinitive that has the time value, and that itself may be somewhat debatable. There aren't very many future infinitives to even look at, and it's something that I've kind of put a note down to have some future study on if somebody wants to do it, just to analyze this idea of a future infinitive and what kind of time value it may or may not have. So we'll just kind of leave that as it is, as you know, might as well take it for what they say and then maybe put some question to it later on, but it doesn't occur often enough to make a big issue of it. Now, as far as the major distinction we have between the present infinitive and the aorist infinitive, and the difference between those two is one of aspect rather than one of time. And the basic distinction is what we've already seen. Present dealing more with a progressive aspect and the aorist dealing more with an indefinite aspect. So the present infinitive represents an action as continuing or as repeated or as customary. And then if a time is involved at all, it must be inferred from the context. So the idea then, you see, infinitive is meaning that it's not limited. You know, it's... So your time isn't so, you know, in English we have the infinitive form of the verb as the form that has no tense value. And the same kind of thing is happening with the Greek here. There's no time in the word itself. There may be time inferred from the context, but it's not in the word itself. But the difference between aorist and present would be one of aspect, indefinite aspect versus progressive aspect. Okay, uses of the infinitive. There's quite a wide range of uses of these, and you can go into a lot of detail with them. They're generally not too difficult to handle when you see them. Once you recognize that you're dealing with an infinitive, it's not much of a problem. And so they break down a number of uses with the anarthrous infinitive, for example. One of the most common uses is a complementary infinitive, and that's very analogous to English usage, where you'll see certain types of verbs that will take infinitives to complement their meaning. Verbs like to be able, you know, to be able to do something, and to be fellow, to want to do something, or to be about to do something, or to be obligated to do something. Those verbs very commonly using infinitives, and that's very, very parallel to English usage in that respect. One of the nasty things about this is that those verbs tend to be quite irregular, and you see the paradigm, for example, dunamai down here, which is kind of an oddball cross between, you know, it's a deponent me verb, but it's irregular even for the me verbs. So that's, I suppose, the worst part of that. Okay, well, we'll stop here and we'll continue reviewing on this next week, and just about there. So some of these other chapters, once we get through this infinitive chapter, the rest of it's going to go pretty fast. Okay. So next week we'll be back into the middle of it.